welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is the truly legendary Dave Mason.
I'm that star.
As I say, we're on Dave's bus. We really have the rock and roll lifestyle here. Okay, so Dave, how long is this tour?
It's only been about, it ends on the 18th of the month, October.
Right.
I haven't really done a lot this year.
How much?
Some in January, early in the year. I think it was January or February, early in the year. And then the first part of it was which was a continuation from the previous year, which was my rock and soul review with me and Steve Cropper.
How do you know Steve Cropper?
Oh, God, I met Cropper a long time ago here in L.A.
Really? So this is after he paid his dues in Memphis?
I guess so. I've been a fan since I was 18, 19 years old.
Well, it's funny. He's such a big guy. You think of a studio guy, and he looks like a guy who could play basketball.
It's great. It was a great show.
So who else was in the band, or how many players did
you have? Well, with my band.
Okay. And just with Steve?
With Steve, my band, and also we had a girl from Maui, Gretchen Rhodes, who was part of it.
Now, some of the time you live in Maui. Is that how you met her?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back a few years. Whose decision was it to have the Pizza album, the first Alone Together, where it was multicolored?
Basically, it was supposed to come out like a sunburst.
Oh, really?
But there was no controlling the colors in the press. So every one of them just came out different.
And whose decision was to do that, though?
I think it was just a collective decision with Camouflage was the company that did the design work on the album. And I guess it's just to put something out, you know, different.
And who was your manager back then?
Alan Parisa was the manager, Group 3 Management.
Okay. And how'd you end up on Blue Thumb?
Through Group 3.
So, in hindsight, good decision, bad decision. Krasnow's dead. It's not a big deal.
Good and bad. It was all good, you know, but bad. I mean, they were all... You know, most people in the music business or musicians, as far as I'm concerned, would either be either that or a life of crime. It would be one or the other.
Okay, let's go back to the real beginning. Where'd you grow up?
Worcester, England.
You know, we live in America. We're like focused solely on America. I know where Worcester, Mass is. Where's Worcester in England?
Worcester's the heartland of England. 12 miles from the Welsh border.
Okay.
And 25 miles from Stratford-on-Avon.
Oh, okay. And then what did your father or mother do for a living there?
Well, my dad was born in 1894.
Really?
Sorry.
So he was relatively old when you were born.
11, she was 52.
Wow.
And my mother was, I think, 46 or 47. My father had a candy store for 48 years and an ice cream factory, but mostly he was races.
He was a what?
Horse racing.
Ah, now I know that's big in the UK. Okay. Did the candy store exist during the Second World War?
Good question. I'm not sure. I suppose it must have done, actually. Yeah, it must have done. My father was in the First World War.
Because I was in candy ration then. It was hard to get.
Probably.
Okay, so.
But he knew, you know, he knew a guy.
He knew a guy, right. And the ice cream factory he owned?
Yeah, it was just a small one for making ice cream for the store.
And so you had as much ice cream as you wanted?
It was Willy Wonka.
Couldn't have been better.
At the time.
Okay. So, had either of your parents been married before?
No.
So, how many kids were there in the family?
I had one sister that has passed away. There was about 17 years between us.
And just the two of you?
Two of us, and then my father had three kids from a previous... Oh, well, my father was married before. I had from right. a previous marriage.
And were you close to those kids, or they were already in their own world?
No, not really.
So were you...
I mean, he pretty much kicked them all out when they were 16, 17. You know, so you'll take care of yourself.
So were you like the, you know, the fair-haired child? Did they put all their investment in you? Or were you more ignored and let able to run free?
All of it, pretty much. I was spoiled.
And when did you first start playing music?
Well, I guess music and stuff was pretty much from, you know, at school. School choirs, stuff like that, school plays. And then, you know, pretty much guitar was kind of, it was like the next thing for model airplanes for me.
So we were pre-Beatles, same time as Beatles?
A little before.
Okay.
Before. I mean, it wasn't something... My dream was to go in the Royal Air Force.
Really?
Mm.
Where did that come from?
It's what I wanted to do.
And so...
I wanted to fly.
Why? How, when did you... Well, you, I'm sure you flew on other substances further down the road, but when did you give up the dream?
Well, pretty much, I just wasn't... My... You know, most of it was just my math skills weren't up to par.
So did you try?
Pass the exams for it.
Right.
So.
Did you try?
Not really, because it was a question of going to the right schools. And I just basically didn't really try that hard.
Okay. So what time, what age were you when you got your guitar?
Well... I guess, I don't know. My sister had moved to America anyway in the 50s to San Diego. And my mother and I went and visited her when I was around about, I don't know, probably, gosh, I don't know what year it was. Maybe I was 12, 13.
Yeah.
And that's where... A lot of things for me were different because the rate what was happening on the radio, TV was, you know, I mean, we grew up with, you know, black and white TV and one station, the BBC. And a lot of stuff that for me was on the radio shows.
And so.
Or Radio Luxembourg or things like that. So about a lot of stuff, I got turned. Of course, that was the you're at the beginning of all that, you know, bands and guitar and then while I was in San Diego, I found this ukulele in a trash can and just didn't have a clue what to do with it, but I sort of banged away on it, and then I guess when I got back, I was still in school. I got my Dad bought me a guitar, and I used to take it to school. So it was basically that. I mean, I just, you know, I saw these other things, bands and stuff. I thought, well, shit, I could do that, I think.
So you're a confident gentleman.
I guess. I didn't know any difference.
Okay, so was it tough coming back to the UK after being in San Diego?
Not that I don't think so.
Okay, you say you brought your guitar to school. Did they have like a music program or you played?
No, I played in art class. I got, you know, talked to the art teacher. Do you mind if I bring this in there?
And are you self-taught?
Yeah.
And can you read music?
Nope.
No way. Okay, so how far do you go in school?
Well, I went to what was called a secondary modern. Pretty much of which there were A, B, and C, and D streams. And I pretty much was in the A stream.
A stream being the best.
Yeah.
And how did that end for you?
Well, you go there until you're about 16. And then you either go into college or you go to work. And for part of the time, I figured I would try my hand at being a draftsman. Went to a technical college for about a year, a half. And by then, I was getting more and more into playing and figured I just knew that I was never going to work 9 to 5.
Because your personality, or it's
not. I just
was
never going to work for me. I was never going to. There's no way.
Because you're not good with order and bosses, or you're not good with the structure.
All of it, probably. I'm just, you know.
And were your parents supportive?
My mother was, yeah.
Well, that would imply your father wasn't.
Well, I pretty much, I sort of exited myself at about 16 anyway. Out of the house.
And did you support yourself after 16?
Yeah.
Okay, playing music at that point?
16, 17, we had, I think it was about that age when we formed the Jaguars. Played, pubs, local gigs.
And covers, I assume?
Oh, yeah, all covers.
So what was the game? So what year are we in, like 66, 65, 63?
Oh, God, years are like... I forget what year Traffic started.
67, the record came out in America.
Came out in 67, so would have started basically in 66. So yeah, it would have been 65, 64.
So you're playing with your band, you're playing covers, and you happy, or you say there's got to be something bigger than this?
Well, no, I was determined it was going to be successful, one way or another.
Okay, so was it a regular band with the same guys?
At first. But then it sort of changed around. There was the Jaguars, then we had a band called The Deep Feeling. And then Jim Capaldi and I got involved in a band because he lived 12 miles away from me. And he had a band called... He was sort of a... Jim was like an erstwhile Elvis, fronting a band called the Sapphires. And then we formed a band called the Hellions. Actually did a record for Pi, a Jackie DeShannon song, which went nowhere. Went out and backed, I think it was with the Hellions. I'm trying to remember if it was with them. Went out and did a tour with backing PJ Proby.
Wow.
And then I kind of moved down to London and...
Go a little bit slower. So when you're playing with these bands, do you feel these bands are going to make it, or you're better than the bands and you have to carry the whole thing?
I don't really know. I was just... I was hoping any one of them could, really, I suppose.
And so who got you the deal with Pi?
With that group, the Hellions, we got signed. We had a management company down in London. A guy named Morris King, who the other two... I forget what other acts. There was one act, the Walker Brothers. He had the Walker Brothers.
One of whom just recently passed.
And so that got me more into the sort of professional scene. And then, we played a lot of gigs in Birmingham, which is basically where Jim and I met Winwood.
Oh, really? Okay. So Jim, you met just because in the band scene, he was fronting a band.
And then we,
Right.
It finally sort of got to where you pulled. We tried to pull the best of all the local bands and find the guys and put them together.
And when did Jim start playing the drums, stop being a front man?
I don't know. Basically, he was never a drummer. He just could just do it.
Okay, so how'd you meet Winwood in Birmingham?
I met him at a place called the Elbow Room.
And so you were just hanging out, or you went to, or you were performing, or he was performing?
It was an after-hours semi-private club owned by a couple of guys, a Jamaican guy and a guy named Don Carlos.
And at this point, Winwood had already had his hits with the Spencer Davis group.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dimples was a hit when he was 15. So.
Right. And so how did you decide you were going to form a band?
We just started kind of hanging out, basically. Just hanging out, smoking a lot of hash, listening to all kinds of music, and just hanging out when we could. And I guess he got to the point where he just didn't want to be Spencer Davis Group anymore.
So when you were
to do something different, and during that time, through all that, I was a roadie for them for about 3-4 months.
Okay, so when you were, you know, Winwood was a star, and when you got to meet him, was he just another musician, or did you say, this guy is a star, or this is a guy I can work with?
Well, I'm about star. I mean, he just was, you know, he was just had an inordinate amount of natural talent. So, and Jim and I, we were fans, and so, you know, it just sort of, but then, like I said, we just started hanging out, basically.
And so you were a roadie for the end of the Spencer Davis Group or for the beginning of Winwood?
Well, I'm singing the harmony on Somebody Help Me.
Oh, really?
Me and Jim are both on Give Me Some Love and I'm a Man.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay, so when you met him before the heyday of the Spencer Davis Group, because you were singing on all those songs, I'm a Man, Give Me Some Love, those were the hits in the U.S. I know he had previous
success. I mean, they had, you know, Keep on Running,
right.
All those things were big hits in England, Europe.
Okay, so while you were hanging with Winwood, have you stopped being in your own band touring around, or are you still doing that simultaneously?
At that point, I didn't really have a... Well, I played with a guy named Don Covey for a little while in London. And then when it got more to the point where the four of us were like, we're going to, you know, Steve is really going to leave, and we're going to form a band. So I didn't do anything for about 3-4 months or more. And that's why I was playing road manager with Spencer Davis Group.
Okay, were you a road manager or
a
roadie?
Well, not roadie, like a roadie, kind of a roadie. I mean,
oh, so you did a little bit of everything.
I was just there to hang out with Steve.
Okay, did it feel like a step down, as, you know, doing the behind-the-scenes stuff instead of being on the front?
No, I didn't care. I mean, I knew we were going to form a band, so.
And how did everybody react when Steve said he was going to leave the Spencer Davis Group?
Not too happy. Spencer flipped out. I mean, I get it. I mean, he was the Spencer Davis Group.
Exactly. There was nothing after that.
You know, so, and that's basically how, you know, kind of Traffic started.
Why was it named Traffic?
We were trying to come up with a name, you know. And pretty much every band was the. And we were trying to think of something different. We spent weeks with, what about this? What about this? What about this? And then Jim and I were at a movie, an afternoon movie in Worcester. And the cinema, when you came out the front doors, had steps that went right down onto the high street. And we walked out, and he just went, I got it. Traffic.
And did you think it was a good idea immediately?
Oh, yeah, immediately. It was like, yeah, perfect.
Okay, just so I know, how far is Worcester from Birmingham?
It's about 30 miles.
Okay, relatively close.
Yeah.
And then how did Chris Wood get involved?
Chris was a friend of Steve's.
And he was always going to be involved?
I guess. I mean, they were friends. He was an art school guy.
Okay, so now you form Traffic. Chris Blackwell comes into the situation.
Well, he managed Spencer. He had Spencer Davis Group anyway. It's at Steve.
Right. So, I mean, did you feel like, well, now I've really hit the big time, or?
Well, I knew that at that point, being involved with Steve, it was certainly going to get attention.
And then was Blackwell helpful, unhelpful, good, bad?
In what sense?
Hey,
creatively or just?
Okay, he was a businessman. Doesn't he get credit for producing that first record?
No, he didn't produce the first.
Yeah, but I think he takes credit though.
Probably.
Okay.
He took everything else, pretty much, so.
Okay, there you have it. Now, when you want to go, are you signed individually?
I mean, Jimmy Miller produced the first album.
Right.
He brought Jimmy Miller. Chris brought Jimmy Miller over to produce Traffic.
And Jimmy Miller, one of the unsung heroes of rock and roll. So what was he like? Because he died way before his time.
Jimmy was just great. Just very cool personality. Great producer. But with Traffic, it was, you know, Steve wanted to get away from the young Ray Charles dub that he got and do something different. So, and at first we talked about a lot of covers and doing, you know, Bobby Bland stuff but when it started, that was when I sort of went, you know what? I need to start writing.
Oh, you didn't write before then?
No.
Wow.
First song I ever wrote was their biggest hit. Fantasy song called Hole in My Shoe.
Right.
Which was the beginning of the end.
Why was it the beginning of the end?
It was the beginning of the end because a bunch of reasons. I'll never know really why. But most of the things that I wrote were because I was there for the first two albums.
Right. But let's start with the first album. First album, you're in the band and then you're out of the band.
Well, I wrote sort of nearly half the songs, and we were kind of like one of the first little group of people that just sort of, we sequestered ourselves away in that house in Berkshire, which had no electricity, no running water, until we started putting it in there, just to see what we could come up with. And I was trying to, you know, I didn't know what I could do or couldn't do, so I wrote on my own. And they were pretty much naive songs because I had street smart was not part of my upbringing.
Okay, but literally, between the album coming out in the UK and the US, you're no longer in the band.
Yeah, pretty much. And the thing that happened was that Hole in My Shoe became a number two record in England and was a hit in Europe. And for me, it all happened so fast. And suddenly that thing that you've been wanting is there.
Right.
Press, this, that. It all got too much for me. And I couldn't deal with it. It was basically what happened. I'm just a kid from Worcester. I grew up, my upbringing was not unlike Tom Sawyer. I'm running around in farms, building rafts, bows and arrows.
Okay, so
it was all too much for me. So I left.
And you left, and you intended to do what?
I didn't know.
But you felt you were done with this music game.
No, not at all. I mean, I never got into this to be a star. I got into this to make music and make money.
Which came first, make music or make money?
Well, the music always comes first.
Okay, so when you leave Traffic, the spotlight is upon you. Did you see any of the money from Hole in My Shoe?
Who knows? I have no clue. Must have seen something. I mean, Blackwell took all the publishing on everything because I didn't know any different.
Okay, so when you leave the band, what do the other three members say?
I don't know. They pretty much sort of went on as their own. It was the three of them.
And how did you come back to the band for the second album?
They were in. Well, whilst in that time that I'd left. See, part of it was Traffic was an interesting group of. Because we all have a very diversified musical tastes. I mean, we loved all kinds of music. So, which I thought was its strength. And didn't really matter who wrote the hit song to me, because at least that got attention to the band, and there was so much other material there. And so after I had to take a break from the fame, I guess, of it. But that's when I got to know Hendrix. Got to know McCartney. I produced an album called Music in a Doll's House for the group called The Family. Put out the first compatible stereo single. And I come back to America a few times.
And for what reason?
Because mostly for the reason I finally came here, because this is where it all starts. This is where it all comes from.
Okay.
We just copied you.
Well, that's for you.
We just copied everything and sold it back to you.
I know. Exactly. We were asleep at the wheel.
And the other big thing is, we all in England, Europe, is we didn't have all that segregation going on. We didn't, you know, that's why we had all those great, that's why that blues stuff happened so much over there. There wasn't any radio segregation of music over there. So we heard it all.
So you're saying you heard it all in the UK?
Yeah.
So were you caught off guard when you experienced the segregation in America?
I mean, I don't know if I really paid that much attention at the time. To be honest with you, but anyway, I sort of came back and forth a few times, and also at the time, during that period of time too, I went to Greece for a couple of months to the island of Hydra to work on songwriting. Because I thought my stuff was sort of Hole in My Shoe is just a little fantasy thing that was a hit. But I wanted to write more just about life things, real things. My whole thing with songwriting is to write something that's timeless. I don't want it to be trapped in a fashion or time or a place.
Since you had a number of hits, did you write trying to have a hit? Or you said they just...
Yeah.
You did.
Well, I have a somewhat of a pop sensibility.
Okay. So how do you come back into Traffic for the second
album? Well, I was in New York and they were at the... I think they were at the record plant in New York working on the second album. And all they had were five songs. And I was at the studio visiting, and I said, well, I got five songs. Oh, all right. Well, we want to come, sure, let's record them.
Well, you had, except for 40,000 Headmen, which is a great track, you had the three best tracks on the album.
Well, Feeling All Right is...
Well, Feeling All Right, but that's a famous one, but it started, the album started with You Can All Join In, and my favorite song is on the second side, Crying to Be Heard.
Oh.
So were those songs you'd written in Hydra?
Pretty much.
Okay. But you talk about Hole in the Hole in My Shoe being your first track. Most people write, you know, I read 100 songs, the first 90 were bad. Were you someone where every track, every song you worked on, and then it became quality?
Well, I, you know, basically I don't, I'm not very prolific. If I write something, if it doesn't feel right, I just throw it out. So I'm usually just concentrate. I concentrate on what my version of quality is rather than quantity, I suppose.
I guess my question would be, those three tracks on the second album, were those songs that you wrote right after Hole in My Shoe, or had you written a lot of other ones?
No, they weren't. That's when... I mean, it took me 2 years to write those 8 songs on Alone Together.
Okay, but let's go back to the second Traffic album. What's the story on Crying to Be Heard?
I don't even remember. Just whatever it's saying.
Okay. How about...
I mean, it's a song I've never done. I've never sung that. I've never performed that song.
Why?
Ever. I mean, I thought it was cool, but... A, I don't have that voice anymore. For one thing. And... you know, I'll do All Join In. But for me, Crying to Be Heard was just it was an album track.
It's important to me. But in any event, what's the story on You Can All Join In? Remember how that came together?
I think I wrote most of the lyrics for that sitting in a cafe, outdoor cafe in Athens.
And you know what inspired it?
Just basically exactly what it's saying.
Okay.
Pretty much.
And what's the story of behind Feeling All Right?
Feeling All Right's, Feeling All Right is about not feeling too good myself. That's what Feeling All Right is.
And what was the inspiration for that?
A girl, of course, a woman.
And did it come
early? All are.
Okay. You have this, did the song, a lot of times when you're in that mood, that depressed mood, the creativity comes and it comes out all in one batch. So did the song kind of write itself, or did you work on it for a long time?
I mean, part of it too was I was trying to, musically, I was trying to write the simplest thing I possibly could come up with, because I had been playing sitar for some time, which I used on the first album. And George Harrison gave me the sitar that he learned on to start with. So I've been playing sitar and I've been listening to a lot of Indian music. So having been listening to that basically around a drone, it was part of the, for me, was trying to write the simplest possible thing I could come up with. And other than one chord, 2 chords.
Okay, now that song, you know, is literally legendary, played a lot today. Does Blackwell own the publishing on that, or do you?
No, I don't own the publishing on it.
But you still get the writer's share?
I do.
Okay. And then do you know how Joe Cocker ended up covering it?
Not until Denny Cordell, I mean.
The producer.
Got him to cover it. I mean, that's the definitive version.
Okay, so you like it.
Oh, yeah. You kidding? I wish I'd have done it like that. I mean, I do on pretty much on stage.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's an adaptable song. You can do it in so many ways. You can do it as a reggae song if you want.
So how did it end with Traffic? How did Traffic decide to break up?
So after the second album came out and... Of course, my songs were the single picks. And then I got a call to come to a meeting at Chris Blackwell's house. And so I go over there, and Chris and Steve and Jim are there sitting on a couch, and I sit down, and it's like, okay, what's going on? And Steve looks at me and says, I don't like the way you sing, I don't like the way you write, I don't like the way you play, and you're out of the band. And that's how it ended.
And what did you say?
Didn't say anything. Just pretty much got up and left.
And do you see Winwood ever since then, or no?
He doesn't see me.
But you maintained a relationship with Capaldi, right?
Capaldi's passed away.
I know, but before that.
Sort of.
But the band itself ended up imploding.
Sure.
So they didn't have your hit songs.
Well, possibly. I don't know.
Okay, so you're done with Traffic. Where does that leave you?
Out on the street, pretty much wondering what the hell I'm going to do. And we tried a couple of things. I mean, it was one point where Steve had left the band. And
Steve had left the band, but the other three of you were carrying on?
We tried to carry on with a guy named Winder K. Frog. But it was, you know, you're not going to replace Winwood.
Right.
So, you know, after all that, I just finally went, you know what? I'm out of here. That and the 98 cents and the dollar taxes in England. It was like, you know, fuck this shit. I'm out of here. I'm going west. And that's when I up and left and came here.
To Los Angeles.
Came to Los Angeles.
Now, especially with today's situation, we're all very familiar with immigration law. You can't stay here forever unless you get a green card or you get a special visa. How'd you end up being able to stay?
I am an alien resident.
Okay, but back then, back in 68 or so,
you came. That's what you
applied and you got that.
Yeah.
Okay, you a citizen now or still in it?
Still an alien resident.
Do you vote in the UK?
Nope.
Do you care about Brexit?
I hope it passes.
Because?
I think it should.
Just very simply, why?
Because I just don't think that wrapping yourselves around the rest of Europe is going to benefit England in any way.
And do you go back at this point?
I've been back maybe twice, three times.
Really? In 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you move.
I don't sell any records there. Never have.
So you're in America.
And I have no other reason to go back there.
You're in America, and then what do you decide to do?
Well, I stayed with Graham Parsons for a little while.
How'd you know Graham?
I knew him through, met him through the Rolling Stones at a session.
We've gone through Hendrix, we've gone through Harrison. How did all this happen? Are you just the kind of guy who everybody gets along with?
You could run into everybody. And there's only one place. It's not like America, where you had, you know, how many music centers? L.A., New Orleans,
right.
Philadelphia, New York, Detroit, San Francisco. It was all just London, and that's so you'd run into everybody there. There were a limited number of studios. And Jimmy Miller was producing the Stones, and Hendrix and the Stones and Traffic and the rest of us were all using the same studios. And it wasn't unusual for people to just drop by each other's sessions.
And were you starstruck by these guys?
So I played on Street Fighting Man.
What are you playing on Street Fighting Man?
Some of the drums and that weird horn at the end of the...
Really?
Yeah.
How do you end up playing the weird horn?
Brian was a little too... He wasn't there, actually. And then Hendrix and I, during that period of time where I'd left, there was a little rift going on with him and Noel Redding. And Jimmy and I actually talked seriously about me taking Noel's place.
But that would be playing bass.
Right. And we did some recordings, me playing sitar and bass, so I have no clue where they are. And then I got to sing on Crosstown Traffic and then played the acoustic guitar and All Along the Watchtower.
Wow. So, but then you come to the U.S.
Then I finally come to the U.S. And I'd known a band over here, which I'd tried to tell Chris Blackwell, you should really, really sign this band if you want a really great band, which was Delaney and Bonnie. So I knew all those people. And I played guitar with them for a while.
Now, you were also in the band at the same time Clapton was in the band.
Well, Delaney and Bonnie opened the Blind Faith tour.
Actually, where I saw the Blind Faith tour in Chicago, Taste was the opener, but
we opened a lot of the dates. We were on a lot of the dates, and that's where Eric got to really grab all, you know, get to know all that.
And were you cool with Eric?
Yeah. I mean, I was in the band of Derek and the Dominoes at the very beginning.
And how did that end?
It mostly ended because that's when Eric got into heroin. There's not a lot was getting done. And I was getting frustrated and just said, okay, I can't deal with this.
Who else was in the band at that point?
Well, Jim Gordon.
Jay.
And most of the Delaney and Bonnie band. Bobby Whitlock, Jim Gordon, Carl Radel.
Right. And so how do you end up writing Only You Know and I Know, which is on the Delaney and Bonnie album On Tour?
Well, I'd written those. That's part of Alone Together. And those eight songs were written over a period of 2 years. And I wrote Only You Know and I Know up at Cass Elliott's house.
You ultimately did an album with Cass. How'd you meet Cass?
Through Graham Parsons.
Graham was the type of person who knew everybody himself, right? But he at the time was on heroin too, right?
I guess. I mean, I really wasn't aware at the time.
And Cass was done with the Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah.
And what was your relationship with her?
Well, the thing was, there was a couple living there at the house up in Mulholland that were really close friends of mine from London. And I had no idea that they were there. And so it was like, oh my God, people I actually know. This is great. So that was a reason that I started going there a lot, spending a lot of time there in 69.
Right. And so you wrote Only You Know and I Knew there.
I started writing it there. And that and I think, and I was pretty much at the time, I was kind of living at Chateau Marmont, which is where I wrote Can't Stop Worrying and finished Only You Know and I Know. I think at one point Jim had come over or something. Somewhere we got together and and he had, I had some music and a rhythm of something that I was doing, and he had these lyrics, and I read the lyrics and I went, oh, okay, they'll fit with that. And that became Look At You, Look At Me.
Okay, and then at the point, if you're living in the Chateau Marmont, you must have had some money from somewhere.
There was royalties. And there was stuff that I'd play show, you know, dates with Delaney and Bonnie. And then I was also pretty much working on that record deal with Blue Thumb.
So how did that come together? Well, when did you decide you wanted to do a solo album?
Well, I figured that was the whole object of it. I mean, I came here, that sort of, when I came here is pretty much when the Traffic albums started to come out over here.
Okay.
So nobody had a clue who I was, except I had those eight songs.
So how did it come together with Blue Thumb?
Well, that, like I said, that was through Group 3, because they managed Delaney and Bonnie. And that's how I got to that. And that led to Blue Thumb.
And did you think that going to Blue Thumb was good, or would you have rather been at Warner Brothers, Columbia?
At the time, I still liked the idea of independent labels, because without a lot of artists on them.
Right.
Because I figured I'd get a little more attention than being on some place where there's a huge roster.
And to what degree did they give you attention in the studio?
Well, Tommy La Puma was basically...
Right.
Who...
Was a producer.
Producer. Just a real great guy. And Tommy knew all those musicians that I finally finished up working with on there.
So did you have any idea that did you think everything was turning out well?
All I knew was I was making a record.
Okay, well, the record came out from the consumer side. It certainly had the multicolored plastic. It had this three-panel cover you could hang up as a poster.
Right.
And it was one of the few albums of all time you could literally play from beginning to end. There's not one clunker on the whole record.
Well, the great thing about it was when there really was radio, which...
Right, not anymore.
Sadly, is one of the biggest reasons... Don't put anything new out anymore. There's nobody home. But then you had DJs and people who were turning you on to new music. And the thing about that album is it was very hard to see where the grooves, where the tracks started and ended.
Yeah, I know.
So a lot of DJs just put it on and play the whole slam side. So, yeah.
But then you got into a fight with Blue Thumb, right? You didn't want.
It became a hit. And because of my experience with Blackwell and Promise, certain things that he made that he reneged on.
Right.
I said, okay, great. I now want to, if you want to do another one, you need to renegotiate the album. My deal.
Your deal.
And they wouldn't do it. And so I was working on that second album.
So was Headkeeper the second album?
Headkeeper was the second album, which was supposed to be a double album. And and they just kept reneging on it, and I took the tapes and hid all the tapes. I put them somewhere. All the masters.
Okay.
So they went ahead and just put out an album off the rough two-track stuff that was left there. And that's when I went in the press and said, "Don't buy the damn album."
So this was before you made your deal with Columbia?
Yeah.
Okay. So where did that leave you emotionally when they put out all the rough mixes?
I was pissed.
And did you ever make peace with them?
With Kraz now? No.
And did you ever get paid on that those records?
Who knows? He's probably shuffled so many out of the back door. Who knows what he did with it? I think everybody got screwed.
Right.
Don Graham got screwed. Tommy got screwed.
And so how did you end up making a deal with Columbia?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think of the series of events. I think it was after that. There was a fellow named Don Graham, Don Sherman, that managed me for a little while. I'm trying to remember if it was him that's how we got to the Columbia deal.
Okay, were they?
I mean, there was after the success of Alone Together. There was going to be somebody that was going to sign.
Of course. So they were looking for you, would you say?
I would imagine that, you know, I could have probably gone to them or Warner's, or I probably could have gone to all of them.
Right. So how was your experience being on Columbia?
Columbia was a very varied experience.
Okay.
I mean, I've always had freedom to do whatever I want in the studio, because I really don't. I tried once to do something that was like, that was stupid. So, and then there was the whole live side of things, trying to, you know, become a. I mean, for me, I had the hit. I had Alone Together hit record, but I really wasn't. I really wasn't prepared to be a solo artist. So, I mean, we did Columbia, and we did. I forget what order the first album was. Was it? It's Like You Never Left. Was that the first one?
I don't think so.
I've been gone for a while or something, yeah. Or just a Dave Mason album.
I think Dave Mason was first, but I would have to look it up myself.
Yeah. And then, you know, like the problem with the labels, which looking back, I wish they were still, well, I wish a number of things were still around for artists, but they aren't. I mean, things, you know, you were either you had, I mean, the thing was back then when I was back in the days when we first started, somebody made a decision and that moved the whole company. And then as things progressed and we got into this bullshit of consensus, you know, well, everybody's got an opinion. Yeah, okay. Everybody's got a nose too. But unless there's somebody there. So when you had somebody behind you that has some power at the company, you know, you could pretty much get something done. And then eventually it just, you know, it all sort of, and then every, because then somebody would be there for a little while and then they were gone. I mean, there was a great article back in the 70s, early 70s, on the front of the Wall Street Journal. You always put that little column there.
Now it's at the bottom. Used to be on the side, yep.
And they used to be right there in the center of the page. Remember?
Right. Oh, yeah, column. Yeah, with all the news, yeah.
And it was always something a little different. And they did a thing on the record business. And they said, of all the records put out by every label that exists in the U.S., 2% make money. So, you know, there's a lot of cases where, I mean, you got bands that did stuff and made great albums, and the people that were there to help and do it suddenly weren't there anymore. So a lot of stuff was shelved. You know, the labels were an expensive way to borrow money.
And try getting it back. Okay, so how does We Just Disagree happen, and how does that become a hit?
Well, how does it become a hit? Then when I did the, I think at that point I don't specifically remember the times, but the specific order of things. But I think there was a period where and now, part of some things, I had a number of things happen, and I went through a bankruptcy.
While you were signed to Columbia?
I went through a bankruptcy, and it was a legitimate bankruptcy. The thing about a bankruptcy is that the minute you declare bankrupt, you're free and clear to do whatever you want to go and do, unless there's fraud involved, and then you're screwed. But the little part about it is, within the recording agreements of the time, there was no provision for that. And I really wanted to go with Ahmed. And I was broke at the time. And Ahmed loaned me $50,000 personally and took me on the corporate jet for 10 days to Europe to a number of Rolling Stones concerts. And then we got back, and And he said, there's no precedent for this. We don't know what to do. I said, but it, you can sign me. It's legal. It's fine. He said, corporate attorneys, they don't know what to do. He said, I just, and at the time, Clive was at Columbia, and Clive had made an offer to go back to Columbia. And Armis said, just go take the offer. So that's how I went back to Columbia. And that's when I did the Let It Flow album, which was, again, put out, it was put out as a colored album, blue. And had We Just Disagree on it. And at the time, I had a great band, Mike Finnegan, Jim Krieger, Gerald Johnson. And it was a song Jim Krieger had written. And he brought it to me one day. He said, I got this song. He said, this thing is perfect for you. And it was like, it was just a great song. And so that's why I cut it. And then the guys out on the street were important, really important at the labels. They worked the radio.
Yeah, promotion man.
Promotion guys. Mike Gussler, one of them. A couple of other guys. They really helped make that a hit. And Steve Popovich was another great.
Great guy.
And Clive, actually, I mean, I always thought Clive is a great record guy. He's a great ear for stuff. And, that whole, to me, all that whole ousting him for over some bar mitzvah party,
right,
or whatever it was a lot of bullshit, I think. I think he's just getting, I think you had a problem when you got too powerful in some of those places.
Especially
either
big
powerful, or you couldn't make anything happen. You were screwed. So, and then I tried a couple more things and with them, and the Mariposa album, which to me was a really good album, didn't sell. I mean, it went gold, but. And then it just sort of fell apart after that. And then Joe Wizard did the last album I did, and Columbia did nothing to push it. It was one of the reasons why Joe Wizard left Columbia.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the story, basically.
Okay, so now you're done with Columbia.
Nutshell.
Done with Columbia. What do you think? Where do you think you're at that point? We hit the 80s.
Doing what I've always done, playing live.
So at this point in time, how much do you work? How many days a year?
I mean, I've never stopped, basically. I've never stopped really working. I mean, the last couple of years this year is probably the least I've worked. And I mean, last year I took 4 months off. First time in God knows how long.
So where can you play? Pretty much anywhere in the world?
U.S.
Just the U.S.?
U.S., some Canada.
Dang. And you see a new audience, or is it the same diehard Dave Mason
fan? It's the same. It's the people who've grown up with me, basically. You know, my audience is basically 40s to 70s.
And do you still... And
occasionally I get, you know, there's young kids come, and usually they're like, wow. It's all new to them, but nobody's playing it to them. There's nobody there.
No, right.
Nobody, I mean, radio is just, everybody talks about the internet and the power of the internet. Terrestrial radio is probably more powerful than the internet. It's still a very... powerful media, but
certainly
there's nobody there. So you don't put. It's why we don't put music out anymore, and we're getting screwed worse by the internet companies than we were by the labels. 5,000 plays on Pandora is about the same. Your check's the same as the price of a T-shirt. I mean, half of our revenue stream is gone. So the all you're left with is playing live. I mean, that's why I still play. I play for a couple of reasons. Probably the same reason I gave at the very beginning of the interview. I love playing, and I'm really good at this point at being Dave Mason, and it's the only revenue stream that I have.
So are you going to die on stage, or at some point you're going to call
Don't miss the last show.
And on that note, Dave, thanks so much for doing the podcast. I don't think we can top that.
Thank you.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.